I'm Marco Werman. When Lucia Luca sings, she wants you to focus on her voice, not her gender identity.
I had a theater director in Germany say, oh my gosh, this trans thing, it's so hot right now. I don't want that. I want it to be not a thing.
The everyday, normal life of a trans opera singer, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Alabama Senate just passed the most restrictive abortion law in the U.S., a near-total ban with no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. Doctors would face long jail terms for violating the law. If it goes into effect, the measure would pose a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade at the national level. That is the domestic analysis of where we are at on abortion. We want to put this in a global context now, and for that we called author and law professor Michelle Oberman, who studies abortion regulations around the world. Michelle Oberman, we're going global here, so my first question to you is, this new law on abortion in Alabama, would you find a similar law on a national scale in any country around the world?
Yeah, it looks a little bit like El Salvador's law, which bans abortion under all conditions. But if a woman is actually at the point of dying, then the law of self-defense will kick in. So Alabama's law that says that if there's a serious threat to her life reminds me a little bit of that law that I've studied in El Salvador.
But the number of countries around the world that would have a similar law is so restrictive. I mean, is it a low number or is Alabama in line with a lot of countries around the world?
Alabama is going to be putting itself along with a handful of countries that are the most restrictive in the world. I mean, it's worth noting that while the laws are the most restrictive in the world, the rates of abortion in the countries that have these restrictive laws are, if anything, higher than the abortion rates in countries with liberalized abortion laws.
Mm. And what do you think that tells us?
It tells us that the number of abortions in a given country are responsive not so much to whether it's legal or illegal, but rather to how expensive it is to have a child. Abortion is something that happens when a person feels like they cannot afford, in whatever sense afford might mean, another child.
Let me bring in The World's Alison Herrera, who covers gender issues for us. Alison, you've reported on Argentina's abortion laws, and you're actually about to travel there to do some more reporting on this subject. What is the law in Argentina right now regarding abortion?
Well, Marco, the law around abortion for decades in Argentina was that abortion was allowed when a woman's life was in danger and in cases of rape or incest. In 2012, the Argentine Supreme Court moved to clarify that law. There were a lot of restrictive interpretations of the law that said only women with disabilities who'd been raped could receive an abortion. In 2012, the Argentine Supreme Court moved to clarify the law about who could receive an abortion in the case of rape or incest. And so then a more expansive interpretation was put in place in 2012 that said it applied to all cases of rape.
So what's at issue now in Argentina? Why are you going back for more reporting on abortion laws?
Well, the issue now is that legalizing abortion across the board was put up for a vote in 2018. It didn't pass. So now what's happening is women on both sides of the issue are getting activated because it's an election year. Some candidates have really run for abortion rights, and some of it because of a very controversial case involving an 11-year-old girl who was pregnant. She was the victim of incest. The family wanted her to have an abortion, but the person in charge, the health minister in her state of Tucumán, intervene and confuse the issue. So it became unsafe for her to have an abortion. So they terminated her pregnancy through C-section and the baby died. That whole episode really riled people up. So it put a focus on abortion in this year's election.
Michelle Oberman, let me come back to you on this. Which countries around the globe in recent years have further restricted access to abortion? And generally, what forces have been behind those moves?
So I think the more interesting question is the countries that have liberalized their abortion laws in the past couple of years. Both Chile and Ireland, countries that have a majority Christian population, have had complete bans that they have liberalized in the past 2 years. And they've liberalized them, I think, for two reasons. The first is that there are only a handful of prosecutions happening every year. So the laws are all but impossible to enforce if your target is to stop women from having early abortions. And then secondly, the world of misoprostol or abortion drugs has transformed the landscape of access to abortion, meaning that women with a smartphone and a little bit of cash are able to order drugs that permit them to safely end their pregnancies. So what you end up with in these countries that have strict laws are doctors who are hesitant to treat patients who are pregnant because they're worried about the law. So, for example, you're an obstetrician and you're treating a patient who gets breast cancer. So you refer your patient to the oncologist. The oncologist is not sure how to treat the breast cancer because they can't terminate the pregnancy, or they worry that they can't terminate it. Is it a serious threat to the woman's life? And so you end up in these situations where doctors are unable to give their patients the care that they need for fear of prosecution or for confusion about the law.
I'm also wondering, when you look at the global trend toward authoritarianism, Michelle, I'm thinking of Russia, Hungary, Poland. Does that trend include trying to make abortion illegal or restricting access further?
No, definitely not. You see a real wide range of laws around the country, around the world, rather, in terms of abortion. And so it's hard to say, oh, authoritarian regimes are authoritarian always in how they regulate or restrict access to abortion. You know, I think it's a litmus test in our country, and it's a litmus test largely because all we've asked of our lawmakers is that they sign up on one team or the other. You know, are they pro-life or are they pro-choice? And we haven't really asked what impact changing the law will have. I mean, meaning that if you're a pro-life person and you really want abortion to go away, you should be paying attention to what happens in France, where the rate of abortion is really low. Mm. You shouldn't be getting your lawmakers to ban abortion. You should be figuring out, oh, wow, what does it look like in a country that doesn't have high abortion rates? And lo and behold, you see a whole different set of policies. You see mandatory paid maternity leave. You see child allowances. You see subsidized daycare. You know, their rate of abortion in France is half of our rate here in this country.
It does feel like the U.S. is exceptional when it comes to abortion as a political wedge issue. Any other place in the world where abortion plays that role?
I mean, I've been studying lately Israel, where abortion is so strange. You have to go to a committee of two doctors and a social worker and tell your story, and they approve or they disapprove it. And I thought, well, for sure you'll have a divisive debate around this. It's a completely settled issue. It's been the law since 1977. Nobody cares about these committees.
All right. We will leave it there. Michelle Oberman and Allison Herrera, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Oberman is a law professor at Santa Clara University. We also heard from The World's Allison Herrera on her reporting about Argentina's abortion debate. Prepare your burial shroud. It's either you or your country. A Sudanese twist on Live Free or Die, that protesters were chanting on the streets of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, today, just days after the government fired on demonstrators, killing six people. Hours later, though, some positive news. Sudanese leaders announced an agreement with the opposition for a 3-year transition period to civilian rule. Still, government militia attacked the demonstrators again today.
Right now, as we speak, we're hearing live ammunition shot and people being assaulted in the streets.
That's Tagreed Abdin in Khartoum. She's an architect and mother of three who has lived in the city for decades. And she's been marching in the demonstrations since they began in December.
Today, Khartoum is very chaotic, to say the least. Residents have set up roadblocks inside neighborhoods and on the main streets. So it's a site of burning tires and broken bricks. And as a friend said, it seems very dystopian today. So what's going on right now is the main protest is the sit-in that's happening at the military headquarters. Today, I was surprised when I went out that there were roadblocks and burning tires and the closed-off roads.
Yeah. Well, if it feels dystopian in Khartoum today, perhaps that shouldn't be a surprise, especially after the relatively violent evening on Monday for the crowds that are continuing, as you say, that sit-in outside military headquarters. This is what they faced Monday when soldiers broke through the barricades. So members of the Sudanese security forces shot and killed six people on Monday, including an army officer. Tagreed, that's a clear escalation and a departure from what you've seen in recent weeks, isn't it?
Yes, actually, it was a very alarming escalation that was actually very unexpected. These young men and young women that are guarding the roadblocks that lead into the sit-in, they've always known that they're the first line of fire. They've always expected to be targeted. That's why I'm calling them the guardians of the revolution. They know that they're the front line. They know that they're the ones that are most exposed. They're the ones that will sound the alarm to protect the people inside the sit-in. But the fact is that we were very surprised at the escalation and the live ammunition. And the fact of the matter is that yesterday I woke up to a message that one of the demonstrators that was killed was actually the son of a colleague of mine. So it was unexpected. It took people aback because the violence went from 0 to 100. I mean, it was very alarming and disturbing.
How are Sudanese trying to understand that or explain it?
There is a very high degree of appreciation of the sacrifice of these very young men that we've seen killed in the attack the day before yesterday. They're 16, they're 20 years old. We don't really have time to grieve, and we need to make sure that everything is documented, that they're honored, that they're commemorated. So right now what we're seeing on social media is pictures of these young men, celebration of their lives. People are saying you have to come to the funeral service, people exchanging locations and information regarding how we can honor these martyrs. And in the end, the demand for justice for the people that committed these acts is a top priority for all the demonstrators.
As almost a contrast to that, we hear news that former President al-Bashir is going to be held legally responsible for the deaths of protesters during the demonstrations. And Sudan's military leaders have announced an agreement with the opposition for a 3-year transition period to a civilian administration. Are those hopeful signs for you? And what do these actions mean for Sudanese?
I want to quote another friend that was saying all of this would have been acceptable the day before the attacks. But the fact is that the military is still resorting to violence. That means that we're still in a very dangerous place. Because the fact of the matter is right now, as we speak, I was just watching a live video of soldiers still physically attacking people that were passing by, guarding the roadblocks or filming them.
How hopeful are you right now that what you and many others started in the streets will result in democracy?
We've been under a dictatorship for 30 years. So there's a lot of political immaturity. People are just, you know, like sending out feelers for the democratic process itself. I mean, to us, it's been a lot of theory and not a lot of applied science when it comes to democracy. It seems that there's a lack of good faith, we can say, in the discussions and the talks if, in the end, the army is still going to pull out a weapons card.
Tigreed, what worries you the most right now, either for the future of Sudan or for you personally?
The worry is that the revolution will be hijacked. That's still a very clear and present danger. And the fact is that the people in the streets with their bodies and our fallen youth, they're guarding the revolution with everything they have. So these efforts to dismantle the sit-in or the roadblocks, they're very scary because this is where the power of the democratic leaders, you know, the people pushing for change, this is their power, the demonstrations, the sit-ins, the roadblocks. This is where we hold power.
Tigreed Abdin, an architect and mother of three, speaking with us from her home of Khartoum. Thank you very much and stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A global push to police extremist content online is gaining momentum. Leaders from several countries, as well as tech executives, gathered in Paris today, and they signed an international pact to take tougher measures to identify and eliminate violent content. The effort is spearheaded by New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Here she is speaking about the pact earlier today.
New research, strengthening terms of use and community standards, shared technology development, and establishing a crisis response mechanism present very real and very tangible points of difference and change.
The World's Lydia Emanuelidou is in the studio with me. What exactly does Prime Minister Ardern want to see happening here?
Ardern has been calling for tougher measures on violent and extremist content since March, since there was that horrific attack in Christchurch, New Zealand. As you know, the shooter there killed 51 people. He live streamed the attack on Facebook, which then that video spread on several different websites. He also used social media platforms to spread his manifesto. And Ardern has been saying since then that New Zealand has been doing everything in its power to prevent this sort of thing from happening again, like reforming their gun laws, which they did very quickly. But she says that this problem of extremist and violent content, she can't fix that, and her country can't fix that on their own.
Right. And so is that what the meeting in Paris is about today?
Yes, that's right. So she co-hosted this meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris, and there were lots of other world leaders there. Canada's Justin Trudeau, the UK's Theresa May. There were also representatives from Norway, Senegal, Indonesia, and other countries. And there were also the big tech companies. Facebook, Google, Twitter sent representatives. There were others as well. And they all signed this pledge, what they're calling the Christchurch Call to Action, essentially committing to coming up with technical and other solutions to address this big problem. Here's Ardern again.
The challenge for us will be, how do we maintain people's free and secure access whilst trying to prevent in the future the harm that we've seen? But we will constantly have both in mind.
So, Lydia, what does this actually mean? Like, is this pact binding in any way or mostly symbolic?
It's a non-binding commitment, so it is mostly symbolic, but it's still a really big deal. It shows that there's really a lot of momentum to get governments and tech companies to collaborate on these policing efforts. There are countries that have come up with their own laws and proposals on regulating online content, but Ardern has said that this can only succeed if there's collaboration, and that's what she tried to do with this pact and this meeting.
Yeah, and it seems pretty significant that all these world leaders and these tech companies from Silicon Valley are there. Where is the U.S. in all of this? Did they sign on?
They did not. They did not sign on, though they did release a statement saying they support the goals of the pact. And when Ardern spoke this afternoon, she said U.S. officials were in touch with them as they were coming up with the language in this pact. But again, ultimately, the U.S. did not sign, and reportedly it was because of concerns around free speech. And that's not really surprising because, you know, here in the U.S., lawmakers have been reluctant to propose any legislation on this because of First Amendment protections. But this does create an interesting dynamic because you have these tech companies and a global movement to regulate the content on the platforms, but almost none of that is coming from the U.S.
There was Lydia Manalidou. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
President Trump often claims it's too easy for undocumented immigrants to stay in the United States by seeking asylum. But since Trump took office, the number of people receiving asylum is down, even in parts of the country where some immigration judges tend to be more willing to rule in favor of asylum seekers. WNYC's Beth Fertig has more from New York City.
On a recent weekday morning, 10-year-old Daisy is accompanying her mother to immigration court in Manhattan. They've been living in New York for almost 3 years, ever since they came from Guatemala without papers. Daisy knows it's a big day.
They're going to tell my mom if we're going to stay or leave.
She definitely does not want to leave.
I don't want my mom or me to get killed in Guatemala.
Daisy stayed in a waiting room during her mother's asylum hearing. I was in the courtroom, but I wasn't allowed to record the proceeding. Here's what happened. Daisy's 40-year-old mother testified in Spanish before an immigration judge. She asked that we withhold her name because of the uncertainty of her immigration status. She was joined by her lawyer and a translator. First, Daisy's mom gave her side of the story, how she was severely beaten by Daisy's father, starting when she was pregnant, how she filed an order of protection against him, and how he was robbed by gang members, a scary episode that prompted her to take her daughter to the U.S. A lawyer for the government then picked apart her story. For example, when Daisy's mom got to the border, she told an asylum officer about the gang, but not about the domestic abuse. The government's lawyer also got her to acknowledge her allegedly abusive partner made no attempt to keep her in Guatemala. The hearing took about 90 minutes, and afterwards, Daisy's mother was shaken. Her lawyer, Sophia D, steps in to translate.
I was so confused. She was asking so many questions that I thought were the same questions, and I was answering it, but then she would get angry.
She was also frustrated. D says government lawyers who work for the Department of Homeland Security have changed their tone at asylum hearings.
They're trying to make getting the client to say something that's inconsistent. They're trying to attack their credibility. They're trying to win, as opposed to determining, like, if this person really deserves asylum or not.
That could explain why more immigrants are being denied asylum. According to researchers at Syracuse University, more than two-thirds of immigrants nationally were denied asylum this year, compared to half 4 years ago. It's a trend also seen in New York City, where the immigration court has traditionally been viewed as liberal, but where today more immigrants are being denied asylum. Immigration lawyers believe that judges are getting tougher. They work for the Justice Department, and last year, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions made it harder for judges to grant asylum to people escaping gangs and domestic violence. Dee says she's been losing more cases since then.
You're not excited to go to court because it's not going to be that happy day that you're used to having when you just change someone's life.
Other immigration lawyers said they're also losing more cases involving domestic violence and gangs. It's hard to prove these cases are driving down asylum rates, but Ashley Tabador, president of the Immigration Judges Union, sees a possible link.
The big surge of cases that we have seen in the recent past are coming from Central America, and many of those cases focus on gang-related violence or domestic violence-related claims.
Many migrants are also escaping poverty, which is not grounds for asylum, and some do make false claims. Daisy and her mom won't learn until July whether they've won asylum, but Dee recently represented another client from Guatemala, a mom who said she was threatened by a gang member for refusing to let him take her teenage daughter. The woman did not win asylum, but the judge agreed to let her stay in the U.S. and work. She was happy after the hearing.
Me sentí contenta.
Dee says this decision would have disappointed her a few years ago because the client can't ever qualify for a green card. But
in today's current political climate, with the case law that we're working with, today was a win.
And today, she'll take whatever wins she can get. For The World, Beth Fertig, New York City.
I'm Marco Werman. When Lucia Lucas sings, she wants you to focus on her voice, not her gender identity.
I had a theater director in Germany say, "Oh my gosh, this trans thing, it's so hot right now." I don't want that. I want it to be not a thing.
The everyday, normal life of a trans opera singer, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Trump administration today ordered the partial evacuation of the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. It was in response to what the administration has warned is an increased threat from Iran. Another White House response to that threat, reviewing plans for a military conflict in the Middle East, including one that would reportedly send 120,000 troops to the region. Suzanne Maloney studies Iran and the Middle East at the Brookings Institution. I asked her what intelligence the Trump administration has received about the threat from Iran.
There is some real ambiguity about that. The White House suggested that Iran is, in fact, planning attacks against American interests or personnel in the region. There has been, obviously, a response in terms of pulling non-essential personnel from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. And there are, of course, reports that the White House is studying military options on Iran.
Well, let's listen to what British Major General Chris Agyika had to say in response to the warnings of new threats from Iran.
There's been no increased threat from Iranian-backed forces in Iraq and Syria. We're aware of their presence, clearly, and we monitor them along with a whole range of others because that's the environment we're in. But as I say, we have no part of Iran in our mission. We are monitoring the Shia militia groups carefully, and if the threat level perceives to go up, then we'll raise our force protection measures accordingly.
Other U.S. allies, as you know, Suzanne, seem to agree with the assessment from the U.K. Also, we're hearing from the European Union's Foreign Affairs Chief, Federica Mogherini, calling for maximum restraint after meeting with Mike Pompeo. How can we interpret these responses to the Trump administration's warnings?
Well, I think it's quite stunning. I won't say unprecedented, but it's highly unusual to see this level of public disagreement between American and British officials since the United States has exited the Iran nuclear deal. There's been a real effort on the part of the Europeans to try to avoid a full-scale breach with Washington. I think what we see here is a deep sense of foreboding about precisely what the administration is up to, why these non-specific threats have been publicized, and why the United States is taking such fairly noisy action to apparently deter Iran from undertaking any of these attacks. I think, you know, we have a real transatlantic rift here, and there is an effort on the part of our closest allies in Europe to ensure that we don't find the United States moving down a path that is reminiscent of the war with Iraq.
Do you think it then comes all back to the Iran nuclear deal? I mean, are the sides that are worried about threats and the sides that are like calling for restraint defined by who continues to support the JCPOA?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that starkly. I think in talking to European officials over the course of the year since the Trump administration exited the deal, they too have suggested that they're concerned about Iranian actions around the region. But I think there's also a sense of deep resentment, even as European officials seek to maintain some consensus with Washington. Resentment that it is in fact the Trump administration's decision to walk away from the deal and then to impose really severe economic sanctions on Iran that have had a catastrophic effect on ordinary Iranians and on the potential stability of the regime there, that in and of itself has been a precipitating factor to the threat level that we see today.
We have to remember, too, that there were disagreements about intelligence ahead of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. So how are we able to evaluate the intelligence this time around? And how concerned are you, especially in this age of fake news and disinformation, that a casus belli will be especially hard to verify?
Well, I think this is where the intelligence community and the Congress here in the United States and similar institutions in Europe need to really step up to the plate. It is absolutely essential that there is an effort to try to vet the information and make public those details that the Trump administration is claiming justifies any change in our force posture in the region. Unfortunately, given the president's own difficulties in distinguishing between truth and falsehood, I think we have a real credibility problem on our hands. One of the concerns here is that this is a kind of rush to war that isn't being fully vetted even within the defense establishment. We saw something similar in the run-up to the war with Iraq. And I think there are real concerns about how serious the plans are and to what extent they've been fully shared with Congress. I think that's going to be a key element of any next steps, is ensuring that there is serious congressional oversight.
Suzanne Maloney with the Brookings Institution, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Pentagon's war plans for Iran also include a massive cyber operation dubbed Nitro Zeus. According to the New York Times, it calls for, quote, unplugging Iran's major cities, its power grid, and its military. That sparked our curiosity because it would appear to take cyber warfare to a whole other level, far beyond the limited targeted cyber attacks we've seen in the past. Peter Singer is a senior fellow at the think tank New America and co-author of Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. Nitro Zeus, I mean, it sounds like science fiction. I gather even the name comes from a science fiction video game. Can it be done?
It can be done. The question is whether it should be done. And that's true whether we're talking about cyber operations or this larger idea that's been talked about of over 120,000 U.S. troops on the ground. In each of these, they are areas where the U.S. has the capability, but when we're talking about whether the cyber operations or an overall campaign and frankly this overall crisis, we're really now getting into issues about the wisdom of it.
I also think of 2017 when it was hurricanes that crippled the power grid and infrastructure in Puerto Rico and thousands of the most vulnerable people died. Isn't that a likely consequence if a cyber attack caused the same damage?
I think it's hard to predict what the exact damage would be without knowing what the scale of the targets are. Are you talking about turning off the electricity in a particular building, in a particular missile site? Or are you talking about turning off the electricity in an entire country? It's just, it's really hard to come up with those kind of estimates.
We saw with the Stuxnet virus that the U.S. used to take out an Iranian nuclear facility in 2010 that it is difficult to contain these viruses and malwares, kind of like biological weapons. How do you prevent them spreading beyond the target?
Well, so it depends on how tailored the operation is and the design of it. So Stuxnet was interesting in that it popped up in 25,000 plus other computers around the world. However, it didn't activate in all of those computers. It actually could only go after a particular set of targets. It was a particular type of machinery in a particular geographic location. So even if you had, you know, a bunch of nuclear centrifuges in your basement, it still wouldn't hit those. It was only hitting the ones in Iran. But it does point to, again, about how if it's not well designed, sometimes these things can hit widely. So it really, again, circles back to, what's the scale of the operation? How tailored is it? Essentially, are people thinking this through? And then you get to the other side that we need to talk about, which is, of course, the retaliation.
Right. Well, how well prepared is the United States for cyber retaliation?
It's we have built up all sorts of systems that range from new agencies to how corporations are doing it. But the reality is there's a lot of vulnerabilities there. And they've shown the ability to get inside, everything from email systems to infrastructure. So you can't expect them to just, sit back and take it. And so, again, whether you're talking about missile strikes or troops on the ground or cyber strikes is, one hopes that you don't have this kind of literally insane level of optimism that we saw back in 2002 prior to Iraq.
And on that point, I mean, just on the semantics of this, in the case of a hypothetical U.S. cyber attack on Iran, even if there's no boots on the ground or no blood, do you think a cyber attack of the kind you've been describing, is it an act of war?
Act of war, there are different ways of thinking about it. There's the international law definition of it. There's the way a populace thinks of it. The simple reality is when we talk about war, it's the combination of violence and politics. And we don't care about the means. We don't care whether the violence happens by a bomb strike or the violence happens by malware. So if it combines politics and violence, so on the cyber side, we're not talking about stealing email or something like that, but something that has a kinetic effect, has a physical effect on the world that's equivalent to violence by some other means, then people are going to judge it as, being in a state of war.
Peter Singer at New America and the co-author of Like War. Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Tensions in the Middle East are nothing new, but it's not often those tensions come with a dose of Madonna. This tragically overlooked classic is about unrequited love, but it could also be about the Israel boycott. Because even pressure from activists fighting Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories can't stop Madonna from performing at Saturday's Eurovision Song Contest in Tel Aviv. Yeah, some speculated she might back out. Still, Madonna landed at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv last night. And just a few hours ago, she posted on her Instagram a few short rehearsal clips, all to promote her new album, Madam X. I took a sip and had a dream. Lots of artists have refused to perform in Israel, but Madonna issued this statement, "I'll never stop playing music to suit someone's political agenda." Then she also said she'd never stop speaking out against human rights violations. Seems like she's trying to have it both ways. Organizers of Eurovision are hoping for only one outcome, that she'll be there Saturday night. The families of two Cambodian refugees in California are celebrating after the governor there issued his first pardons earlier this week. Democrat Gavin Newsom's actions are being widely interpreted as a rebuke to President Trump's immigration policies. The World's Rupert Shenoy reports.
When Hai Hov and Keng Hen were kids in Cambodia, Americans bombed their country, making way for the genocidal communist Khmer Rouge. Hai Hov's family fled to the U.S., landing in Oakland, California. Kevin Lowe describes it as another kind of war zone. He's Hov's attorney.
He was beaten up. He was stabbed. At age 13, like, he almost lost a leg from a bullet that ricocheted off a wall and, like, hit him in the knee.
Lowe says Hov got swept up in the national push toward incarceration in the 1980s and 90s. When Hov was 19, he was convicted of attempting to set up a murder. Lowe says he didn't do it. Hov's green card was revoked, and he hadn't applied for citizenship.
Some people don't realize that they have to apply for citizenship. Like, there's a lot of confusion about the fact that legal permanent residency can be taken away from people.
Keng Hen was on a similar trajectory out of San Jose. He pleaded guilty to driving a getaway car during a robbery when he was 18. He also lost his green card. The two men could have been deported then, years ago, but Cambodia wouldn't take them and others back. So Hai Hov and Keng Hen served their sentences, got out, and got to stay. They had normal lives with wives and kids.
So a lot of young people in these impoverished communities were swept up in the criminal justice system. And then decades later, like, now that they're mostly in their 40s and 50s, like, those consequences have come back to haunt them.
It's coming back to haunt them now amid an emerging war over immigration between California and the Trump administration.
The crisis on the border is a manufactured crisis. And we are not interested in participating in this political theater. I think it's nothing more than political theater.
That's Governor Gavin Newsom in February, 1 month after taking office, recalling the National Guard troops who'd been sent to the Mexico border. 2 months later, Newsom took on Trump's asylum policies. He said they show a disregard for the Constitution.
Governor Newsom honestly is living in a different world, and that's a very dangerous world he's living in. And if he keeps living there, lots of problems for the people of California. They don't want that.
The Trump administration pressured the Cambodian government to take people back. Anoop Prasad of Asian Americans Advancing Justice represents Keng Hen.
The Trump administration in 2017 placed diplomatic sanctions on Cambodia for not cooperating enough with deportation. And since then, it's just been raid after raid after raid on the Cambodian community.
Immigration officials say deportations of people to Cambodia have increased by nearly 300% since 2017. Federal authorities say nearly 1,400 Cambodian nationals with convictions remain in the U.S. and have been ordered deported. That included Hai Hov and Keng Hen, until this week. In his proclamation pardoning them, Newsom specifically cites their impending deportations and says they don't deserve to be separated from their families.
It's actually pretty rare for a new governor to have the political courage to exercise clemency power early on in their term.
Hov has his green card back, and the governor's pardon means he probably won't be deported. Hen's still in a detention center, but Prasad says the pardon means he's safe from deportation. He says they'll ask for Hen's case to be reopened and his permanent residency restored.
Really, this is Governor Newsom protecting California from unjust deportation policies coming from this administration, while also recognizing that California can do more to roll back mass incarceration and roll back mistakes we've made in our past.
Maybe in these few specific cases, California will have the last word, because these are state crimes and nothing can stop a governor's pardon. But there remain many more cases where the federal government can still prevail. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Just in case you're not familiar with this opera, this is Wotan, the King of the Gods from Wagner's Ring Cycle. And the baritone singing that role? Her name is Lucia Lucas. Chloe Veltman of station KQED recently caught up with Lucas in Oklahoma, where the transgender baritone made her U.S. debut, portraying another operatic alpha male.
On a Saturday at 9 a.m., Lucia Lucas sits down at a noisy diner in Tulsa.
All right, I'll get chicken fried steak and eggs.
How do you want eggs,
though? Double.
Double?
I'm just kidding.
There's been a lot going on in the 38-year-old singer's life lately. The night before, she debuted as Don Giovanni with the Tulsa Opera, becoming the first trans person to sing a lead role in a classic operatic work in the U.S. She had a documentary crew following her around, and her dad, whom she hadn't seen for a decade, flew in for the occasion.
A lot of pressure to still sing well.
Lucas says she'd been wrestling with questions about her gender identity since she was a kid growing up in Northern California.
My mom caught me with makeup before my dad found my stash of girls' clothes.
It was a difficult time. Lucas nearly came out as transgender when she was in college, but her career was starting to take off and she fell in love with a fellow opera singer, a woman. They got married. So Lucas decided to put the decision off.
I don't know, I guess I just sort of thought, like, maybe I can have this, quote, normal life.
Lucas moved to Germany in 2009, and her wife followed 2 years later. Lucas says there was more opportunity there.
It's really difficult to make a career in opera in the US. But in Germany, there's 80-plus full-time theatres.
Lucas was about 5 years into a steady, salaried job as a baritone with a highly regarded opera house in Karlsruhe when she finally decided she had to come out.
There are so many people that would love to have that. To be a working artist, you know, where they make at least enough money to live and continue doing their art full time. But it wasn't fulfilling for me.
Lucas chose the splashy opera ball for the occasion. It was May 2014. One of the company's artistic directors, Jan Linders, says she made quite an entrance.
We were startled. She came fully dressed as a woman, made it clear she wanted to be addressed as Lucia from that day on.
Linda says after they got over the initial shock, the company grappled with what to do about their first female baritone.
Where should be her dressing room? Should it be in the ladies' or the gentlemen floor? How should she be addressed in program books? How could we convey this private change to directors that would cast her?
Lucas says the opera company ultimately decided not to renew her contract, and the company isn't commenting on that. She threw herself into finding other work. She landed freelance gigs with opera companies and sang in clubs and bars. Opera has a long history of gender play. Female singers have masqueraded as young men and boys in so-called trouser or pants roles for hundreds of years. Like Nellie Melba as Cherubino in Mozart's Marriage of Figaro way back in 1910. But professional opportunities for transgender performers have been slow to come about. Lucas says she often gets compliments at auditions, but the nice words don't necessarily translate into contracts. So she often dons fake facial hair and men's clothing for auditions to prove she can play male roles.
A lot of people are really confused because they have Ms. Lucia Lucas on their paperwork as a baritone, but I'm presenting with a beard and masculine attire.
Taking female hormones doesn't raise your voice, and Lucas made a conscious decision not to retrain hers to sing higher parts.
I would have to take off from my day job, which is singing baritone, and I have work through 2022.
For now, she's suspicious of the reasons companies give, if they give any, for failing to follow through on promised auditions or dropping her from their roster.
You know, nobody is fired for being trans. They're fired for being, you know, 90 seconds late or not complying with the dress code regulations.
She says the visibility she's been getting lately has been helpful for her career. But Lucia Lucas hopes the hoopla will eventually go away.
I had a theatre director in Germany say, oh my gosh, this trans thing, it's so hot right now. I don't want that. I want it to be not a thing.
The thing she wants is to continue to play baritone roles like Votan and Don Giovanni without anyone making a big deal of the fact she's a woman. For The World, Chloe Veltman, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay, I know it's hard to remember what happened last week, but last year we had the story about a South Korean violinist, Won Hyung-jun. He'd been working desperately to bring North Korean and South Korean musicians together for a concert. He said it was his way of honoring his grandfather.
My grandfather came to South Korea during the Korean War, and he and his mother got separated. My grandfather had a pair of her shoes. and he put those shoes in his drawer. So whenever he works, he just opened the drawer and to check, you know, his mother's shoes.
Juan tried for years to make this concert happen, and he got really close in 2015. A performance he organized near the border between North and South was canceled at the last minute for security reasons.
It was really sad because I really, really believed it was going to happen. Honestly, I felt, yeah, maybe it's our destiny.
Then just last weekend, it finally happened. Juan performed together with the North Korean soprano Kim Song-mi in Shanghai. At one point, they joined hands and bowed together for the audience.
함께 이제 리허설도 하고 함께 이제 식사도 같이 하면서.
Kim, the vocalist, told the Associated Press that for that moment at least, it felt like unification had come. Of course, the concert by itself probably won't lead to a major diplomatic breakthrough. North Korea's testing missiles again. But as Juan likes to say,
music is the only ultimate medium of understanding through which people are forced to listen to each other, regardless of backgrounds.
And we'll leave it there with violinist Juan Hyung-jun performing the iconic Korean folk song, Arirang. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios in Boston at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.